is U.S. versus Lazarick Alexander. And for the appellant, Mr. Kinch, along with Dean Robel. Nice to see you.
May it please the court, good afternoon. What should really trouble this court about this case is how the police entered my client's apartment and what they did once they got there. After arresting Lazarick Alexander and finding a gun under a car hood, the police officers did not go and obtain a warrant to search his home. Rather, what they did was they went into his apartment complex and performed a dog sniff. The dog did not alert. The police then knocked on the door and informed my client's 22-year-old girlfriend that they had her, that they had arrested her boyfriend in the parking lot, and that the apartment was suspected to contain drugs. They asked her for her permission to search the apartment, and she expressly and unequivocally denied their permission. Undeterred, the police then decided to perform a second dog sniff, at which point the dog entered the common area of the apartment, and upon an equivocal assertion that he possibly detected drugs at the door, the police returned outside, and after consultation with the officer in charge on the scene, the police at that point decided that it was necessary to enter the apartment without permission in order to preserve the status quo of the apartment to prevent the spoliation of evidence. Again, when they made this entry the second time, they did not have a warrant. But what legal authority did the police have to enter? They never claimed exigent circumstances, and they had no warrant. The government essentially here is using their knock and talk to create a situation that required them to preserve the status quo under Segura versus the United States. However, without the information that police gave to Mrs. Harris, she would not have known that they were targeting her home. Second, unlike in Segura, in this case, Mrs. Harris invoked her Fourth Amendment rights repeatedly and was in her home the entire time while at least four police officers attempted to persuade her to sign a consent form. They were sitting at her kitchen table and in her living room at this time in the middle of the night. Segura does not stand for the proposition that police are allowed to use their time in a person's home in an attempt to persuade them to and overbear their Fourth Amendment rights in an attempt to get them to sign a consent form. And in fact, I would direct the court's attention to page 812 of the Segura opinion, at which point the Supreme Court said the police cannot exploit their presence in the person's home. And that's exactly what the police did here. Now, the government contends that...
Wasn't that referring to exploit it by looking around for things that would give them probable cause?
No, Your Honor. We certainly don't argue that the police are allowed to enter the home in order to check for their safety and to make sure that no evidence is destroyed or tampered with, but they're not allowed to use their time when they enter the home and attempt to overbear a person's Fourth Amendment rights to get them to sign a consent form. And that's what's really troubling about this case, is that that's exactly what the police were doing. Ms. Harris had repeatedly rebuffed their attempts, as the magistrate judge notes on page 18 of his opinion. She had repeatedly rebuffed their attempts to obtain her consent to search the apartment, and eventually it was only after it drew late into the night that she finally agreed that she felt like she didn't have any rights and that she was going to sign the consent form.
Well, she just didn't want to figure it was inevitable they're going to get this search warrant. So isn't that when she decided to let him search after talking to her mother or somebody?
Well, I would argue first, Your Honor, that...
They had already found the gun in the car, right?
They'd found the gun in the car, that's correct, but there's a lot of questionable facts surrounding the search of the car.
Well, you know, we'll get to that, but I'm just saying that preceded this. They're now up there at the apartment. The dogs made a second sniff, which is, you know, questionable, but nevertheless, they're on their way to get a search warrant, isn't that right?
Right, but the police are using their presence in the apartment at that point under Segura.
Yeah, she didn't like that. I'm sure that's no fun, having them hanging around.
Yeah, that's correct. She obviously didn't want them in her apartment, and she told them, you need to go get a search warrant, and that's what the police should have done. They should not have used their time in there to attempt to convince her that you should just sign this consent form because it'll be so much easier and so much faster for everyone. I think that's turning the warrant requirement into a question of police convenience rather than into a question of necessity in this instance.
So you'd be arguing that they shouldn't have the ability to stay there to preserve the status quo while they're getting a search warrant. They should be have to leave.
Well, they should be able to stay there to preserve the status quo, but they shouldn't be able to simultaneously use their time in there to try to obtain consent, is my argument.
So they shouldn't ask for consent. They should just proceed with the warrant process?
Well, they should. I think that they can ask for consent at the outset, but once a person stands on their Fourth Amendment rights, and that's what's happened here, is she's repeatedly stood on the Fourth Amendment and indicated, I do not want to consent to a search of this home. I like my privacy. You'll have to go obtain a warrant. That's what's happening here. And by analogy, the Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that when a person stands on their rights under Miranda versus Arizona, that the police are not at that point allowed to attempt to talk them out of that. And that sort of logic should be applied to the cases involving the Fourth Amendment. Now, knock-and-talk investigations generally achieve two things. They put the police in a position to obtain views, sights and sounds and smells of the apartment in order to gather evidence. And what they also do is they put police in a position to obtain consent. And these practices are largely widespread and undercut the fundamental notion of the Fourth Amendment that homes are entitled to special protection by a judicially authorized warrant. A more limited rule would allow knock and talk, including allowing police to obtain information for later use in a warrant, but not permit the police to seek to enter due to exigent circumstances that they created by the knock and talk, or to allow the police to seek consent regardless of whether they have probable cause. If the police feel that they have probable cause, they should do what the Fourth Amendment commands, and that's to go and obtain a warrant. Now, and in addition to all of this, there's more questionable facts surrounding the search of the vehicle as well. The government contends that Mr. Alexander does not have standing to search the vehicle because, or does not have standing to object to a search of the vehicle because he disclaimed ownership. However, in the police officer's report, they indicate that at 8:33 p.m., the search of the vehicle produced a bag which contained a handgun. At 9:18 p.m., several minutes later, the officer indicated that Mr. Alexander said, "This is not my car." However, the police cannot use that against Mr. Alexander if they found out about it after the fact. And then there's also, in addition to this other cast of characters, we have the questionable nature, again, of the repo man, who seemed to almost be in cahoots with the police at this point, and the repossession here, which the police relied on in order to obtain consent to the search, appeared largely, if not entirely, symbolic. The repo man had no means in which to obtain control of the vehicle. He had no keys, he had no tow truck, and he wasn't even present when the police arrested Mr. Alexander. The police effectively repossessed this vehicle. And the Supreme Court, in conclusion, I'll just wrap up here because I'm seeing I'm eating into my rebuttal. The Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that searches conducted outside the judicial process without prior judicial approval are per se unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, subject only to a few specifically established and well-delineated circumstances. And I'm referring, of course, again, back to the search of the apartment. Police incentive has always been to push the exceptions, and the court's duty is to push back, especially when it comes to the protection of the home. And without eating up any of my rebuttal time, I'll reserve the balance unless your honors have further questions.
Thank you.
Ms. Rumbelow, nice to see you as well.
Good afternoon, your honors. Thank you. Rita Rumbelow on behalf of the United States. I'm going to start in chronological order. First, addressing the defendant's contention that the record isn't clear when he denied any ownership interest in the vehicle. The record is very clear. At several points during the evidentiary hearing, both officers Dan Nail and Matt Schradel testified, specifically at pages 18, 22-23, and 38, that Mr. Alexander was sitting in a squad car by the time the officers had obtained the consent to search from the repo man and had lifted the hood of the engine compartment. And this came up because the magistrate judge was a little curious as to whether or not Mr. Alexander could actually see the search of the engine compartment. And we know then, too, that in support of his motion to suppress, the defendant had submitted Officer Schradl's report attached to his motion. And in that report, Officer Schradl states, I arrested Mr. Alexander. I was walking him to the squad car. Mr. Alexander started making noises. He wanted to talk to his girlfriend up in their shared apartment. And at that point in time, that's not my car, said Mr. Alexander. That's Antoine's car or Antoine's girlfriend's car.
It's the driver.
That was the driver, correct. So it was at that time, immediately after arrest, when Officer Schradl was taking Mr. Alexander to the squad car, that he first denied any ownership interest in the car. Again, it was Antoine's or Antoine's girlfriend's. Then Officer Schradl placed Mr. Alexander in the squad car, because then he testified at the evidentiary hearing that he was with Officer Nail when they lifted the hood of the car. So the record is very clear that Mr. Alexander made the denials prior to any search of the engine compartment taking place. He then later also continued with the denials, and I think that that's what counsel referred to during argument. And then he also, of course, denied any ownership interest in the gun. And he has always never, or he has never expressed any ownership interest in the gun. So he did abandon his right to then challenge the subsequent search of the engine compartment. He abandoned any expectation of privacy in the car. The subsequent affidavit that he submitted was completely unsupported. He's just like, yeah, well, it was my ex-girlfriend's car, and I made the car payments with absolutely no supporting proof. So that is why I think that just based on his abandonment alone, the district court correctly denied the motion to suppress evidence. But even if he did have standing, the record is also abundantly clear that the repossession man had authority to consent to the search of the car. Remember, Officer Nail was already in the process of looking for defendant Alexander based on an outstanding arrest warrant, as well as the information that he had received from the apartment complex manager. So Officer Nail was in the process of looking for Mr. Alexander independently. Then he hears over the dispatch, hey, by the way, a repossession man is also looking for the same car that you are. Great. I mean, it just worked out very, very well. So when Officer Nail then continues his legitimate efforts to arrest Mr. Alexander on an outstanding warrant and accomplishes that by arresting him, and both the driver and the passenger say, that's not my car, I mean, what do they expect the police to do? Leave it sitting there? I mean, the police could have towed it. But no, they had already known that the repossession company wanted to repossess this car. And Officer Nail had already heard that on dispatch. Like, presumably, this happens frequently. The repossession companies ask the police to stand by. It really is analogous to probation officers saying, you know, I want to conduct a search of a probationer's apartment. We just want the police to stand by for security. It's the same analogy. So this happens. So once Officer Nail effected this arrest, and both the driver and the passenger disavowed any ownership interest in the car, it was completely legitimate for him to say to the repossession man, here's your car.
Was there any evidence about the repossession protocol about inventorying contents of the vehicle once they repoed it?
Yes. At the evidentiary hearing, the government submitted exhibits, which were the actual contracts. Remember, the owner of the car, or the person who the car was titled to, was Jennifer Felstead, F-J-E-L-S-T-A-D. That was Mr. Alexander's ex-girlfriend. She had signed this agreement, and in the agreement it said, in the event of repossession, the repossession company is allowed to inventory the car. And then Officer Nail spoke with the head of the repossession company and testified to that at the evidentiary hearing. And the reason they are allowed to do that is to avoid later claims of stolen property.
Was the repo guy, did he have his truck there? I was confused about that.
He pulled up. He had a clipboard. And again, Officer Nail was very satisfied that Brian Bowman was who he said he was because he had received the earlier dispatch.
You say he pulled up.
I think he, well, what happened was once Officer Nail knew that the repossession company was looking for this car. He called Brian Bowman, the repo man, and said, by the way, I'm also looking to arrest this individual. I'll let you know if I do. Brian Bowman then just was at a gas station waiting. And then once Officer Nail arrested the defendant, he waited a minute or two. This is part of the record. And then he called Brian Bowman and said, I think this is the car. So Brian Bowman then arrived at the scene of the arrest. And I think Officer Nail's testimony was that he think he had to call a tow truck. Because, of course, the repo people wouldn't have keys to the car. So they, you know, tow it away.
Well, that's what I'm asking. I mean, I envision a repo guy driving up with a tow truck. I don't know. Maybe that isn't what they do. But
in this case, Detective Nail, he couldn't remember. He's now a detective. At the time, Officer Nail, he couldn't remember whether he had shown up with a tow truck or whether he had called him. But he showed up with a clipboard. He didn't just automatically take the car. Officer Nail glanced at the clipboard, and that's how the magistrate judge concluded that he'd shared his paperwork. But the repo man was very careful. He said, prior to me taking this car, I need to verify the VIN. So again, I mean, he had the paperwork on this clipboard with him. Officer Nail did not take the time to read through it, you know, line by line, but he was very satisfied that the repossession man is who he said he was, and he was. So after verifying the VIN and verifying that was the vehicle that they needed to repossess, he then said, okay, I'm going to repossess this car. And then it was at that point Officer Nail asked for consent to search. And again, the repossession company could inventory all the articles in the vehicle, and that's what they do to avoid later claims of stolen property.
I'm sure the repo man wanted the search.
He would have once they got it back to the repo
man.
No,
he not wanted to do it himself. If there's something in there, I don't know. Maybe they told him they're looking for a gun. I don't know.
I don't know if they did.
Whatever
or not.
It is, that he's not going to get in the way.
Right. But there was absolutely nothing unlawful about the way that this was handled. And then, of course, because the confidential informant who'd called saying all this stuff about Lazarek Alexander, you know, he's cooking cocaine in this apartment. He's known to be in this white car. He's got a handgun in the engine compartment of the car. Of course, once all that turned out to be true at the scene of the arrest, when the officers knocked on Venice Harris's apartment that she shared with the defendant, that in and of itself, the magistrate judge found and the district court adopted, was sufficient probable cause because everything that the CI had said was true was true. So you take it one step further. The CI also said that there were narcotics located in that apartment, and I don't know if the CI said there would be an additional firearm in that apartment or not. But then the police didn't just act on that alone. They were careful. They had the K-9 go around. Yes, the K-9 did not alert the first time, but after the officers entered, spoke with Venice Harris, came out, you know, the K-9 officer testified at the evidentiary hearing. It's very possible the odor of the narcotics came out.
Well, there was testimony about that the opening of the door might have had an impact on it, the ability of the dog to detect drugs. Okay.
Yes. And then the K-9 officer talked about the dog having a 93% success rate. They talked about how training, you know, false alerts, it's very rare. And then, of course, the officers entered the apartment the second time lawfully. They had probable cause, and they were in the process of obtaining a warrant. They didn't badger Ms. Harris. What they did was they just explained the process to her. They just said, look, you've already denied consent once, so we're going to go get a warrant unless you want to consent again. That's all they did was explain it to her.
The reward to the dog was a little different in this instance than usual. It's just a verbal comment or something.
Pardon me?
It was just a verbal comment. It wasn't the usual reward that's mentioned in the briefs.
I don't understand your question. With the dog?
Yeah, the dog. When the dog hit on the sniff,
right?
Instead of getting the usual reward, it was just given a praise, verbal
yes.
praise.
Yes.
What about that?
I think that when Officer Felt testified, I can't remember what he said about it, but he didn't think that was anything significant because of the way the dog had alerted, how they always go clockwise through the apartment. And he testified, I mean, it was asked the question, if this dog saw police officers in and around this apartment door, would that throw the dog off? Would the dog specifically alert because he sees, you know, men in blue who this dog always works with? And Officer Svelte said, absolutely not. absolutely not, that that would not throw the dog off at all. It was only to the alert of the narcotics.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank
okay.
you.
If the court doesn't have any further questions, I ask that you affirm the judgment conviction. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Kitch, how much time left? 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. This will be very brief. Number one, the government contends that the police were standing by while the repo man effectuated the repossession of the vehicle. However, it was actually the repo man who was standing by while the police were the one who apprehended the vehicle and then had to call him from a gas station to come and get the vehicle. Number two...
But they did have cause to do that with the warrant for Alexander, didn't they? They could stop him.
In terms of arrest, stopping Mr. Alexander, yeah, there was an outstanding arrest, or there was an outstanding warrant, so they had cause to at least stop Mr. Alexander, correct. However, there's also, the government contends that this anonymous tip is so richly corroborated with what we found. However, the informant in this case did not call the police to tell them that he suspected someone was cooking drugs and someone was... had a gun and all this. He called the landlady of the apartment, and then the landlady had to relay this. So what we really have is we have a second-hand anonymous tip that was relayed by the landlord of the apartment to the police. Thirdly, if the police waited at least 2 weeks between this anonymous tip and when they actually decided to apprehend Mr. Alexander, even though they knew where he lived from the tip, they knew what kind of car he drove, and they knew his regular pattern. So it's just this constant avoidance by the police of the warrant requirement. And that's why we believe that the judgment of the district court should be reversed in addition to all the foregoing reasons previously stated. And unless the court has further questions, I ask that you reverse the judgment of the district court.
All right. Thank you very much. And to both counsel and especially counsel for the appellant, Dean Rebell, thank you for accepting appointment in this case.